if you could just in a nutshell, Mike, give me a day in the life, your role as producer on The Simpsons.
Okay. You know, I have a very strange job at The Simpsons right now, which is I only work there one day a week. I've worked with the show for 25 years, and I think everybody after a point realizes how much energy they can give to the show. So a lot of us old-timers work a day a week or two or 3 days a week. Very few of us put in a five-day week. But when I walk in there, I'm just this cog in the machine. The Simpsons machine is always running, and we're writing new shows that'll be airing a year from now, and we're tweaking shows that'll air next Sunday. And you walk in on any given day, and you just jump in there, and you work on whatever is going on. And all the work is done communally. It's done by 10 guys sitting around a table. Everyone has a script in front of them, and we'll go through a line at a time going, can this be better? Who's got something better here? Who's got something better here? And my job is just to throw out jokes all day, throw out jokes and maybe story ideas. And if I can make half the people in the room laugh, it goes in the script. So it's a democracy of laughter. It's a laughocracy.
I love that. Yeah, I was struck by that. My wife went to school with a comedy writer by the name of Chris Downey. He was one of the many writers for The Cosby Show and then went on to work for King and Queens, I guess. And I got a chance to meet him last year, and I was really struck by how intense those, at least on those shows, the late-night writing sessions became, meeting deadlines. Is the atmosphere writing for The Simpsons that kind of, I mean, real-time reaction and going burning the midnight oil, or is it since you're a year out, you have the luxury of not having that constant deadline pressure?
What The Simpsons does that regular kind of film shows with human beings in them don't do is The Simpsons works year-round. And, I mean, we literally work 51 weeks a year. We get Christmas and New Year's off. And other writing show jobs are like being a school teacher. You get 3 months off. You do 9 months of production. Then you get 3 months to recharge and cool off a little. So because of that, our hours aren't long, but of course it is intensive. There are 8 weeks a year where we are producing next year's shows and preparing this year's shows. It's this miserable overlap so that there are people at The Simpsons who get paid on a weekly basis and get paid for 64 weeks of work every year.
For 25 years of doing that, I mean, I can't imagine it, but I mean, I want to get your perspective in terms of when you first started your work there, one or two things you picked up along the way.
There's a couple of interesting things I learned. Somebody just was asking me about this, which was my first sitcom job was working on the worst sitcom I had ever seen in my life. It was a show called 9 to 5, and it was based on the movie. I used to watch the show before I worked there because I couldn't believe my eyes how terrible this show was week after week after week. And then they called me up. They said, hey, do you want to work on 9 to 5? And I said, do I?
And we're talking about the Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda classic that goes way back.
Right. And then the TV show starred Rita Moreno and Dolly Parton's niece. and the third woman was played by a hairspray model. So they called me in for a meeting, and they said, our show is about this and this. And I go, yeah, and they work in a spoon factory, and Mr. Hart is the big boss, and blah, blah, blah. And they said to me, we've never interviewed anyone who's actually watched our show before. And I didn't tell them, I only watched it for ironic value. But this is a long way to get to the point that here I am walking onto the show, the worst show I ever saw in my life, and the writers were fantastic. They were so smart. They were so funny. And many of them went on and left that show behind and did a lot of great shows. And so it was a good lesson that the people in TV, even when you see an awful, awful show, the guys who make it, the people who make it in TV writing are generally very smart and very driven, and they work hard. You know, you always hear stories about, like, actors leading these lives of excess, but when you're a TV writer, you have to be sharp every single day. That's your job. So you never drink the night before. You don't stay up late. I mean, we're such homebodies at The Simpsons. And, you know, the idea that we're subverting society would amaze anyone who met us because we're all like a bunch of bankers.
Well, that's something that really struck me too. I mean, I'm a funny guy. My friends think I'm funny, whatever. But I meet someone like Chris again, who writes comedy, and he's 10 times faster than I am. I've always wanted to be a fly on the wall in one of those bull sessions, just to kind of get an appreciation for the speed those ideas come out and how you whittle them down.
I have to say, going into work now after 25 years of The Simpsons and about 35 years of TV writing, I'm still amazed. I walk in, I'm shocked how funny and fast people are, and that, you know, I'm the boss, and look at me, I used to run this thing. I'm always just going, oh, I'm so grateful to be in your company. I'm so happy I made the cut to be in this club. I always think there should be a picture of me outside any TV show just saying, you must be as funny as this guy to get in the door.
And in the industry, has it gotten faster and funnier, or was Jack Benny, just as quick in that the times change? How has the industry evolved along those lines?
You know, I think they were always like this. I had the privilege, you know, when I started out, I was the young guy. Now I'm the ancient guy. But I worked with much older guys who would talk about working on The Farmer's Daughter and, you know, My Friend Irene or whatever these shows were called. These were the guys who worked in TV in the days when TVs ran on kerosene. And they were so funny. They were wonderfully funny and sharp and irreverent. It's not like, oh, it was a different kind of comedy. They were outrageous guys. But I will say, I mean, if you don't know, TV and sitcom business is a business of young men. I mean, the fact that I'm 53 and still working is just a little miracle. And it's not even ageism exactly. It's a lot of the fact is just the hours are tremendously long, and an old guy like me can't quite put in those hours. And an older person is not plugged into popular culture, which is so important for a lot of shows.
Unless you're you or Clive Davis. You had asked yourself in one of the Simpsons stories talks I viewed, what would you do if you couldn't write comedy? And answered with, I'd write for King of the Hill.
Now, oh, did I say that?
You did say that. Now, you don't come across as a rivalry-prone guy, but I'm wondering, is there a big rivalry between the leading tune shops or friendly rivalry? How does that dynamic play out?
There really is no rivalry at all. There's shows we like and shows we don't like. I actually, since I did that joke, I've changed it to Jay Leno. And Jay Leno is a guy I feel I can attack with impunity. King of the Hill was just a show I thought was, you know, deliberately much too slow-paced. I mean, that was it. They said, let's do The Simpsons, but we'll make it so slow-moving that even people from Texas will enjoy it. So that was it. That was my go-to joke. But we all, you know, we're sort of friendly with the South Park guys, and we had a little bit of a rivalry. It was sort of asymmetrical warfare where we would attack Family Guy. We would attack that show and call them a ripoff, and they were always so kind to us. They were always so nice, and since then we've made peace with the show and had Homer Simpson appear on Family Guy, and Seth MacFarlane's going to appear on The Simpsons this year. So no, the bloodshed has stopped.
Well, I'm sure you're going to be warmly received here in Greensboro, North Carolina. But I understand from a recent talk that you gave that The Simpsons have not been, well, let's just say they've been less than warmly received in other parts of the world.
Yes, it's The Simpsons is sort of loved almost everywhere in the world. It's a hit in 71 countries. But whenever we do an episode where The Simpsons visit another country, that country gets furious and cancels the show. And that happened in Japan. They canceled us. In Brazil, we were sued by the Brazilian Tourist Council after The Simpsons went to Rio. And in Australia, we were condemned in the Australian Parliament, which is a Hooters, by the way. And it made me realize, oh, gee, when other countries love The Simpsons, they love it because they don't think, oh, this is a parody of humanity or how people live or families. They go, they're making fun of America. And so they love the show until we come to their country and do to their country what we do to America on a weekly basis.
Is that, I'm curious to get from your perspective, Mike, what that feeling is like when you're, so much going on in this country that we'd all like to see improved or nudged in one way or the other. Is it satisfying? Is it fun? What's the feeling like when you're reaching tens or hundreds of millions of viewers with your point of view or your writer's point of view presented in a funny way? Or give me an example of one that was satisfying for you particularly.
Gosh, I remember, I have only the vaguest memories of this, but it was around 2002, 2003, where, right after 9/11, where Springfield became very anti-immigrant, and they started instituting, like, citizenship tests for people like Apu. And I was very glad to do that we were taking a stand against this sort of chauvinism and, international racism and that kind of thing. I was very glad to see that we could at least go on record saying America has sort of lost its moorings and forgotten what it's all about.
That was back in the days of the Freedom Fries.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, of course, one of the worst things was that we had a character refer to the French as cheese-eating surrender monkeys.
I remember that line.
And then the Republicans in Congress took up this banner. They said, yes, they are cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And it's like, don't you remember we put that line in the mouth of one of our idiot characters?
That's such a great example. I remember that line because I laughed out loud when I heard it.
And there were four of us in the room when the line was written. And when the line became famous, the four of us got together and said, who thought of this? And no one could remember, something that really took the imagination, took the world's imagination by storm. None of us have any recollection of writing the line. Somehow one of us, or probably was a gang effort, I might have thrown in surrender, something like that.
Is that typical, Mike, where literally within a gag, portions of it are contributed by different individuals, or was that a unique case?
It does happen a lot like that. It does happen. Somebody will have the basic idea, and then someone will have an extra improvement on it. By the way, this is how The Simpsons is written. One of our writers will write an original script, and then the other 22 writers will come in and just go over it and rewrite it from top to bottom 8 full times. And if you wrote the greatest Simpsons script in history, by the time it hits the air, 20% of your original script is left. And very often, none of your original script has survived. And you don't take it personally. That's the only way to get fired at The Simpsons, is if you start fighting and saying, oh, you're wrecking my script, or give this joke another chance.
No one likes to hear a whiner. Yeah, I think that's typical. Ever since the movie Amadeus, people think, oh, you artists, it just kind of, you're a vessel. It just flows through you and out to the publisher. But it's interesting to learn just how much crafting and editing and re-editing goes into comedy writing.
It is amazing. And, The Simpsons isn't even the most extreme example. It's the show Arrested Development, which is, very popular, has a loyal cult following. Literally, there was nobody on Earth working harder than those writers. They worked to exhaustion 365 days a year. And I could stop by the Fox lot at 3 in the morning on Sunday and know that I could always drop by Arrested Development and say hi to the writers.
Hey, could you do, I want to, we've already talked about 4 or 5 other Toon Chaps. I'm wondering if I mention a show, you could just give me your first, just off the top of your head, reactions to that, either good, bad, or ugly. These are not personal favorites of mine. Some of them are, but I just a few. I'll throw them out. Okay. Underdog.
Underdog. I loved Underdog, and I was very thrilled to meet the voice, not of Underdog, but the announcer, George S. Irving.
Oh, what a great voice.
What a great voice. And I said to him, please, the man is like 88 years old. I said, will you do please tune in tomorrow for another episode of Underdog? And he goes, I've done Shakespeare, I've done Moliere, but this is what people want me to do. But then he did it.
That's great. Schoolhouse Rock.
Schoolhouse Rock, I like that a lot. I it worked. They were great songs, and they did teach you, and I learned from it. We did one of the best things we've done on The Simpsons was we did a parody of Schoolhouse Rock, and we got Jack Sheldon, the original singer, to come in and do the song for us.
Beavis and Butthead.
Loved it. Thought it was great. It launched an awful lot of writers, too. It gave a lot of young writers like David Cohen, who created Futurama, I think got his first break there.
Okay. Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends?
Rocky and Bullwinkle, I think, is the number one unappreciated source for The Simpsons. I think everything we do on the show that was considered groundbreaking they did it first, including doing a show that looked like it was a kid's show that was pitched squarely at the parents and, you know, full of esoteric references, going right back to Boris Badenov. You know, I was 30 before I found out, oh, Boris Badenov is a parody of the Pushkin novel Boris Godunov.
That's what I love about that show is that was the first TV show that I watched with my parents as a boy where we were just laughing together. And it was probably for completely different reasons, but we really enjoyed that one. And then Tom and Jerry.
Tom and Jerry I like very much. And especially, you know, they were something that went through a lot of incarnations and kind of got cheaper as they went along. But people don't realize, like, the first four or five Tom and Jerry cartoons won Oscars year after year in the 40s. The Tom and Jerry cartoon would win Oscar for Best Cartoon, and those early ones are really great.
Yeah,
I will say, people always think our Itchy and Scratchy cartoons are a parody of Tom and Jerry, and they're inspired by those, but they're actually a parody of Herman and Catnip, this cheap, ugly, violent knockoff of Tom and Jerry, and I think that was the real inspiration for Itchy and Scratchy.
Are there any, a friend of mine who's a composer once said that he knows something's good musically if he hears it and wishes that he had done that, had composed that in that case. Any storylines or scenes of, you've heard recently that you, gosh, I wish I had come up with that. Who do you admire that's going on today out there, if anyone?
You know, animated shows, I do like Family Guy. I enjoy it so much. It makes me laugh. It shocks me, you know. I always think I'm a very jaded guy, and then they manage to come up with something that really makes my jaw drop. I like that, and I like Robot Chicken. That's about it for animated shows. I love this show, Children's Hospital, just for the sheer density of jokes they get in there. And there's a lot of sitcoms on TV these days where everybody talks really fast, and there's a lot of gags in there, but they all kind of suck. And Children's Hospital is this amazing show for being very dense with great jokes where you think, gee, you could have spread these out. You could have done half as many jokes in the show and people would have enjoyed it.
Coming up with Jews and Tunes, an animated evening with Mike Reese, that's going to be March 14th at Temple Emmanuel in Greensboro. Could you put me in the audience?
Yes, it's sort of a look back at my 25 years with The Simpsons, with a kind of an emphasis on Jewish themes, the Jewish writers we have on the show, our Jewish guest stars, the fact that three of our six cast members are Jewish, which means that the voices of people like Apu and the Reverend Lovejoy and super Christian Ned Flanders are all Jewish. And I talk a little about the Jewish content of other work I've done, like The Critic. I did a cartoon called Queer Duck. And I also talk about the fact that even though I'm a Jewish guy with no children, I've written seven Christmas books for children, and I talk about how Jews have sort of been a big part of the Christmas business, going back, you know, really to Jesus. I mean, it was his birthday party, and it just sort of got out of control. So that's it. It's a very fun, entertaining evening. There's animated clips. I tell a lot of stories. You don't have to be a Simpsons fan to enjoy the presentation. You don't have to be Jewish to enjoy the presentation.
You mentioned there was a great exhibit that rolled through Greensboro 2 years ago, which is the Great Jewish Songbook. And it just featured how many of the great tunesmiths from Tin Pan Alley onward have been Jewish. And it translates into the world of comedy and as well. It seems like throughout my lifetime, before then and today, it seems like the vast majority of my favorite writers have been Jewish and comedians. What's your take on historically why so many comedians and comedy writers have been Jewish?
I'll talk about that in my speech. There's a lot of professions that I found Jewish people went into because nobody else wanted to do them. And I think it's like comic books. I didn't realize that, you know, people sort of know, oh, Superman was created by two Jewish guys. But then I found out, oh, yeah, and so was Spider-Man, and so was the Hulk, and so was Batman. I mean, every comic book hero was created by Jews. And, again, I think this is just sort of, here was sort of a low-rent profession that respectable writers didn't go into. All the Protestants were going to work at the New Yorker, and all the Jews were writing comic books. And then once it achieved a little respectability, then everybody started flooding back in. And I find this is what happened in my career in TV. When I started in the 80s, everybody was Jewish. I worked on a couple of shows in a row where Every single person writing for that show was Jewish. And then over the past 30 years, I see, oh, look, hey, the Gentiles see, hey, this is a pretty good job. Hey, this isn't too embarrassing. Hey, this is, there's a lot less shame working on a sitcom than working in a bank. And so the numbers of Jews have gone down. The influence on these shows have gone down.
Interesting. Fascinating stuff, and I'm sure it's going to be a great evening with Mike Rees on Thursday, March 14th at Temple Emmanuel.
I do hope you come. And folks, let me get in. Can I get in one plug for my newest book? It's called Tales of Moronica. It's a book for smart children and dumb adults, and it's a little novella about the stupidest kingdom in the history of fairy tales. And you can only get it as an Amazon download, and it's 99 cents. And I know some of my Jewish friends in the audience will be going, I think we can get it cheaper. You can't get it cheaper. It's 99 cents. If you liked what I said today, if you like my speech coming up in Greensboro, download Tales of Moronica on Amazon. This is probably my eighth trip to North Carolina. You know, I lecture wherever they ask me to, but I keep coming back to North Carolina, and it's great for me, and it's especially great because my mom is from North Carolina. She's from Smithfield, and it's funny. I think they were pretty much the one Jewish family in a town named for ham. And so I have a lot of cousins and aunts and uncles all over North Carolina. So I have a sense everybody in the audience at this speech will be somehow related to me.
Great. Well, if you're in Greensboro and itching for some Korean food, go to Dasarang. They've got great Korean food, just in case.
I will take that. Thanks a lot.
All right. Great to talk to you, Mike. Thanks so much for taking time out to chat with me today.
It was a pleasure. You really know your stuff. This was fun.
I enjoyed it. Take care.
Bye-bye.